Coming to you from Orange County, California, this is the Jug Life Podcast with Max Ada and Chad Wesley Smith. Hey everybody, Chad Wesley Smith here, bringing you another episode of the Jug Life Podcast. I'm joined, as always, Marvelous Max Montana. And today, our special guest from Austin, Texas, U.S. Open champion, Ben Pollock. How are you doing, Ben?
Pretty good. Thanks for having me.
Also, how are you doing, Max?
Yeah, I'm doing all right. In human form today.
Today's episode is brought to you by Windex and weightlifting. It's a lifestyle. And we're very excited to have Ben out here. He's just a week out from his next meet. And did you listen to our U.S. Open preview?
I did, yes, I did.
You are a dark horse.
I was a dark horse, yes.
I feel pretty good about that.
That was a good call.
Yeah.
I have to admit, I was a little discouraged, though, because somebody at my gym who's, you know, he's a teenager, he came up to me and he was like, "You were on the Jug Life podcast. He picked you as the winner." So I got all excited, and then I was a dark horse. I was like, "Well, darn."
But you proved, I'm not sure if you proved us wrong or right.
Yeah.
Either way. We said your name, and then you won, so it's pretty much...
Close enough.
Yeah.
Tit for tat. It's all the same.
So, how many Ferraris did you buy with your winnings?
I did not buy any Ferraris, but now I can pay my tuition for next semester, so I'm in good shape.
Nice.
So, for the people who don't know you, tell them, you know, where you live, where you train, all that stuff.
So, I live in Austin, Texas. I train at Hyde Park Gym there, which is a pretty small... neighborhood gym, but good environment. Lots of weightlifters, powerlifters, some strongman. And I've been competing since about 2012, late 2012. So about almost 5 years now, 4.5 years.
And started out as a USAPL lifter,
mm-hmm.
made the transition to the dark side.
Mm-hmm.
Just in 2016.
2016, yeah. April of 2016 was my first USPA meet.
Okay, and who writes your training? How do you set all that up?
So. What I've been doing is my own training for the most part. When I started competing in powerlifting, my current coach, Jacob Cloud, was really helping me out with all of my training. And over time, as I've gotten, you know, more experience and learned what works, what doesn't work, I do most of my own training until I get to about somewhere between 7, 10, 14 days out. Then Jacob really takes over because he calls all of my attempts at the meets from opener to last deadlift. And so we've worked together long enough that he has a pretty good feel of what I'm capable of, you know, in different scenarios and then the day of the meet. And so we try and plan that together. And usually by that time, by 2 weeks out, you're taking singles, maybe doubles, but no more than that. And so the weight range is pretty small anyway for mm-hmm. what you would take.
And, you know, we talked about this a little bit before while you were training, but you use kind of a unique setup to your regular training. So what does a typical week of training look like for you?
So for me, I'm much more of a intensity guy and don't enjoy volume that well. And so I don't respond to it, probably because I don't enjoy it. But for me, it's more of a moderate frequency, a little bit higher intensity, lower volume kind of approach. And so recently what I've been doing is kind of a setup where I have, you know, a standard three day per week split. But I'm doing that four times. So I'll do Monday, Wednesday, Friday, and then on Saturday I'll repeat Monday's workout. And then the next week I'll do, you know, Wednesday's workout on Monday, and et cetera.
So just to be clear, you'd train Monday, Wednesday, Friday, Saturday, Monday, Wednesday?
Monday, Wednesday, Friday. So Monday, Wednesday, Friday, Saturday every week.
Oh, okay.
It's just I only have three workouts that I'm rotating over those 4 days.
Oh, all right. I get what you're saying. And... So what are those three workouts looking like?
So I've got one workout that's a heavy squat and then some type of medium bench press movement, which is usually a variation. One workout that's a heavy deadlift and then a heavy bench press variation. And then one workout that's a light squat and a light bench press. And so for the bench, I'll use variations. For the squat and deadlift, I typically stick with my competition lifts. I'll, you know, maybe I'll use sleeves on my light days versus wraps or... for deadlifts, sometimes I'll lift conventional, not right now because I'm pretty close to a meet, instead of sumo. But for bench, I'll mix it up a little bit more, incorporate more variation, give my shoulders and elbows a little bit more of a break.
What are your best lifts in training?
My best lifts in training are a 771 squat, I guess, that I hit. It was a little bit high, but I hit that this past week. An 815 deadlift that I tripled yesterday. That was the first time I'd ever lifted that weight. And then a 425 bench.
That's normally how I like to do it. When I haven't done a weight ever before, I usually just do it for a triple the first time.
Well, you got to make sure. You want to make sure it's right. So you give yourself three tries to do it perfectly.
And then if you hit two out of three, not bad, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
You've recently transitioned at US Open, you pulled the conventional.
Yes. Right?
And now at this meet next weekend, you're going to pull sumo.
Yes.
What kind of spurred that change?
So I pulled sumo back last April when I first started USPA. I pulled sumo. Actually, before that, when I was still in USAPL for Raw Nationals in 2015, I pulled sumo. And, you know, I'm a bit stronger sumo than I am conventional. But once I started just kind of playing around, dabbling with knee wraps, which was right after that April meet, I started to develop some inner knee pain when I was pulling sumo. Didn't affect my squat, didn't affect my conventional deadlift. But yeah, when I would try and pull sumo and break the weight off the floor, kind of a sharp pain on the inside of my knee. Not too bad, like I could work through it, but it was enough that it threw my positioning off pretty badly. And so got frustrated with that, went back to conventional. Really brought my conventional up quite a bit, but you know, kept trying to get back into sumo and couldn't really do it. And so it was only beginning of this year that I started working with a massage therapist on a regular basis, and she's helped me, you know, find some things that help loosen up my hamstrings, adductors, and really alleviate that knee pain. So it was about a month or 6 weeks out of the US Open that I finally started to feel like, okay, I could get back into sumo, but we thought it was just too close to the meet to try and mess with things at that point. My conventional was going well, and we felt confident in it. So after that meet, was planning on taking a real long off season, but started working back into the sumo, and, you know, I was expecting to take a month, 2 months to actually even feel the groove again. But, you know, kind of like riding a bike, I guess, just picked right back up where I left off. And so it's been going really well. I really want that deadlift world record that Ed Cohen, who you guys had on for a great show a little while ago, he set that back in the 1980s, 1984 or something. Yeah. So I would really love to try and take that record. And so we figured there's a local meet in Austin this weekend. We'd jump in and, you know, see if we can make it happen.
Thank you to Virus International, sponsor of the Jug Life podcast. Visit virusintl.com and use Jug, J-U-G-G, for 10% off your next order. So, you know, when we talked with Ed the other week, we talked to him about people breaking his records and, like, the differences in circumstance and all that kind of stuff. With you being one of those people who is looking to break those records, does it feel odd or weird, wrong to you to, like, break it under what seems like a bit of a different circumstance?
Yeah, I think he said that, you know, his net record, or somebody said that the records wouldn't ever really be broken because the circumstances are so different with the stiff bar, the two-hour weigh-in, etc. And, you know, I agree with that in not really in a pedantic sense, but in the big picture, yeah. I mean, I think it'd be maybe one day, but no time soon, is anybody going to put up a performance that's that impressive, right? I certainly don't think I'm going to do it this weekend. There's very, very little chance. But at the same time, records are, you know, kind of socially constructed, is the kind of academic term we'd use. And they really are made to be broken. So if the record is 791, you know, technically 792, yeah, even if you're doing it with a deadlift bar, a 24-hour weigh-in, blah, 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 it's not as impressive, but it is still the record. And so for me, you know, that's enough.
The thing that was I think, took Max and I by surprise, what we had never heard about before, was, you know, we knew the two-hour weigh-in, we knew, you know, the full meet and no deadlift specialty bar. But he told us it would have just been for the 181 record, thing he set in 1984. Up until 1984, they were using, like, a raising weight system instead of the rounds system.
Yeah.
So, like, he did 749 as his opener, and then another lifter took 760, and then he took the 791 and pulled it and got it turned down by the judges. But between 749 and his first attempt at 791 was only 2 minutes. And then he had 1 minute to put in his next attempt and 3 minutes, I think, to complete the lift. So in the span of 7 minutes, he had done 749 and two singles at 791.
Which, it's just, like, mind-blowing, right? Yeah. Like, that quick a turnaround.
Yeah.
Is like...
Well, the whole meet went like that, too. So he had, imagine his squats were... He must have followed himself on some of those.
Oh, for sure.
Right? I mean, that is a... That is a grueling amount of work in such a short amount of time. But, yeah.
That was one I had never heard of that. And
Yeah.
That was probably the most impressive part to me about the record now that I know that. It was crazy. So you're currently a PhD student.
Yes.
Where are you at?
So I'm going to the University of Texas in the kinesiology department.
And what are you studying specifically?
My degree is called Physical Culture and Sport Studies. It's essentially sport history with a little sport management thrown in, more or less. Maybe some sociology, stuff like that. But essentially I'm looking at sport history, looking kind of back at the history of anything to do with fitness. So not necessarily just weightlifting, or powerlifting, strength sports, although that's obviously my focus, but anything that's kind of involving exercise in the first half of the 20th century. So up until about the 1950s, maybe early 1960s.
That's a pretty unique program. I'd never heard of that before.
There are very few programs like that in the United States, which is kind of a downside because there's very few jobs. But
that's surprising. I would have thought that's a booming industry. Sports history. Sports history as a.
It's definitely a growing one, and I think you usually find the sport history programs at schools with a big sporting tradition. So Ohio State, Texas, those types of programs where. Sport's very important to the culture there,
right.
And they're more likely to.
What would you do it. With that degree?
Teach, like, pretty much teaching just teach.
Mostly. Okay.
Yeah,
teach other people sports history.
Yeah, there's not too much practical stuff. Yeah,
it's kind of like a system where like you get your friend and then three of his friends to come in and teach sport history. Then those three friends find three more friends each to teach sport history.
It's really just a big academic pyramid scheme.
No, it's not a pyramid scheme. It's multi-level history.
Yes, thank you.
Multi-level history teaching. That's been a big transition for you as you worked other jobs before that. Very interesting jobs, I think.
Too. Yeah, so my undergrad degree was in finance that I got from the University of Virginia, and I worked in the finance field for about three and a half years after that. So I started out working for Freddie Mac, which was a mortgage insurance company doing kind of financial risk analysis, and then didn't really like that, and so started applying for other jobs in the industry and got one at Google, and so moved out to Mountain View for that. And obviously, Google was a great company to work for. It was a great work environment, but I was still doing financial risk analysis, which to me is not the most exciting thing in the world. So
yeah, it's not like sport history.
No, not at all. You know, just enrapturing stuff in the archives.
At Google, is it like that movie, the internship?
I mean, it was pretty close.
Yeah.
I remember one day towards the first weekend I got there, they took us on a retreat to Napa, which was like pretty awesome way to start out work, right? To just go to the wine country and put us up for a weekend, and that was pretty awesome. But like the last weekend I was there, there was somebody like rappelling off the side of the building to test some new product, and I was like, this is pretty wild.
What does Google make that involves rappelling?
Very interesting.
Do you watch Silicon Valley?
Yes, I love that show.
That is a good one. So with the sport history PhD, a doctor, how long before you finish your...
Hopefully next year, fingers crossed, but
so,
yeah.
So when you become a doctor of sport history, is there ever like a sports question on Jeopardy or something that you don't know the answer to?
I haven't had one so far. There was a final Jeopardy a little while ago asking about the bicycle. I knew it. I was so happy. I was like, my advisor would be proud of me if I were on Jeopardy.
Nice. And your advisor is Jan Todd.
Yes.
So I had the opportunity to meet the Todds probably 3 or 4 years ago. Now, for people who don't know, Dr. Terry Todd, his wife, Jan Todd, she was really a pioneer of women's powerlifting.
Absolutely.
And Terry Todd was the first exercise science professor in the U.S., something like that. It was like... They had the first exercise science department at Auburn?
Very possible. I don't actually know the answer to that. I know he was the first powerlifting national champion in his super heavyweight class in 1969, when the sport was just starting out. But honestly, I don't know that much about Terry's academic career.
But we know he coached Bill Kazmaier, and he coached Mark Henry.
And Lamar Gant.
He's pretty good too.
Yeah, he was okay.
What's been kind of one of your favorite things that you've learned from a sports history standpoint? Like your specific like favorite thing to study?
So my dissertation and kind of like where my research focuses on is Jack LaLanne and kind of the very beginnings of fitness on television, because in my mind, that's really where kind of like the Instagram age starts, is like with television, with modern media after World War II, when people start to get more of like a celebrity culture, more of a consumer culture. And so I just think it's ridiculous to look at, ridiculous, interesting, whatever you want to call it, to look at trends that started in the 1950s that you can still go on Instagram and see the exact same thing. So I'm giving a talk tomorrow about Debbie Drake, who had her own fitness show in the 1960s, and was talking about, you know, how women should exercise to look sexy. And, you know, for her, exercise was sitting on the couch while she's talking on the telephone doing, like, scissor leg kicks. And that was supposed to get you in shape and, you know, build your butt and everything like that. And I still think you can go on social media, you can find plenty of exercises that are about the equivalent of lying on the couch doing scissor kicks. But, yeah, to me, that's really cool to be able to kind of look back in history, kind of see where things started, and then hopefully understand them a little bit more.
Yeah.
So, shifting topics from flutter kicks on the couch, you're shredded. So,
thank you.
Yeah. So you must be pretty sharp on the nutrition side of things. What's Ben Pollock's diet looking like?
So to be honest with you, I don't have to pay that much attention to my nutrition because I do have just naturally kind of a...
So you're an asshole.
Yes, absolutely.
Great.
For other reasons. So I follow kind of a carb cycling diet, which, you know, I don't know how popular they are nowadays, but on my training days, I'll have more carbs and more calories, and then on my off days, I'll have less.
Oh, that's carb cycling? I thought that's when you eat around a pizza, like a wheel, until you get to the set. My bad.
Note to self, that might work for some people.
I've been doing this wrong.
I don't know that there's any, like, secret way that works or anything. To me, I just kind of feel better when I have more calories on my training days. And the easiest macronutrient for me to manipulate is carbohydrates, because kind of, like, a lot of fats make me really feel uncomfortable. Like, I feel kind of sluggish and not great, whereas with a lot of carbs, I'm fine. And so... that's just personal preference. I don't think it's, you know, necessarily better or worse than anyone's setup. It's also really easy to follow. It's like, okay, today I'm eating a lot of carbs, or today I'm not eating any carbs.
What does a lot of carbs look like for you?
For me, if I'm not getting ready for a meet, a high carb day will be somewhere around 500 grams of carbs, in addition to the protein and fat. So probably 3,500 calories on the day.
Do you have a preferred source that you're getting those from?
I get most of mine from rice. I like jasmine rice. And honestly, that's just because it's the easiest to get. And that's a lot of carbs for me. I don't have the best appetite. And so that's the easiest way. And sweet potatoes, oatmeal, typical bodybuilding foods. But
yeah.
These guys.
Sounds exactly like our diet.
Yeah.
Sounds pretty much the same.
Except for the pizza crust.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I was carb cycling. Oh, you're gonna get on me for that. I didn't even know what it was.
I do like Fruit Loops after my workout, and so, you know,
I was eating them during other people's workouts today.
Very anabolic.
More carb cycling. Yeah.
So you were the U.S. Open champion, biggest powerlifting meet ever.
Does winning that make you the richest powerlifter ever?
Maybe. I don't know.
Has anyone ever won more money at a powerlifting meet than that?
Not that I know of. Yeah. And since I am a sport historian, I should know.
That's true.
I don't, actually.
You have a title now.
Almost. Next year.
Were you the first to do it? The first winner?
He was the last winner.
Yes. The last winner.
Last
winner.
Close.
Well, you'll never go down the history books.
Yeah, you're the Buzz Aldrin of winning a bunch of money, I guess.
That's the second guy that walked on the moon.
I mean, if I write the sport history books, I can just...
Oh, that's true, because you're probably not the people writing them.
what did that meet mean to you? I mean, those PRs for you and...
You know, technically they were bodyweight PRs, I guess, because I had done more on all three lifts at other meets. For me, the biggest... By far, the number one thing was that it was the first meet where the entire meet I had fun the whole time. Because for me, meets are usually really, like, mentally stressful. Like, I put a lot of pressure on myself to perform, to hit PRs, to win, whatever the case may be. And so that's something that I was really working hard on leading up this meet, was kind of my mental preparation. And I thought I did a great job, which, you know, I'm pretty hard on myself. I rarely say that, but I think mentally I did a great job at that meet. I had a great time. And so that was by far the biggest thing after the $40,000.
What were your impressions of it as an event?
I thought it was really well run. You know, a big meet like that, especially in a huge venue like that, a lot of times it's difficult. It wasn't at a gym, so, you know, a lot of logistics involved and stuff. And I had expected it to run much slower and have a lot more kinks than it did. And so in that sense, like the pacing for me was perfect, because if I had to go back to back like Ed Cohen and do 2 minutes between deadlifts, it's like I'm passing on my second two attempts. And so I really enjoyed that part. And, you know, the area was beautiful. I didn't have a lot of negative things to say about it. And, you know, sometimes you'll go into a meet and the warm-up room will be cramped and you won't have the same type of equipment. And that wasn't really the case. So. Yeah.
You think there's the opportunity for meets like that to grow and sort of proliferate?
I really hope so. You know, I've read what you said, or listened, I can't remember, about the different things that U.S. Open could kind of change, especially in terms of the media. Mm. And I absolutely agree. I think that the media is really kind of the key to powerlifting growing as a sport. And so, you know, pay-per-view live stream is a good way to get in revenue for a meet, which is important. But at the same time, all those sponsorships, all those YouTube views.
Yeah.
If you look at both the history of powerlifting and the history of kind of like emerging sports, in both of those, there's a much larger media presence than there is right now. So back in the 1980s, there were powerlifting meets that were televised on like broadcast stations like NBC.
Yeah, Wide World of Sports.
Yeah, and they were sponsored by companies like Budweiser, which is not something that we have right now, right? But would make a huge difference in the sport. And if you look at other sports that are kind of becoming more popular right now, and I'm thinking in particular of esports, which, you know, whether or not it's actually a sport is up for debate. But the fact is they make a ton of money off of kind of YouTube-type subscriptions, off of sponsorships, advertisement, that type of deal, to the point where, you know, they're on ESPN and powerlifting usually isn't. So
yeah. Some of the esports stuff is mind-blowing. I don't play video games, so I guess I don't have a perspective on how many people are playing some of those. But I saw one where it was the old Seattle Supersonics basketball stadium. Whole thing sold out it was $18 million prize money, or just insane.
Video
games. Yeah.
And you just play against other people there?
This one was a team one. It was teams of six. And I think the winning team won $18 million.
Holy shit.
I never even heard of the game that it was. But
wow.
Then I went out and bought it, and that's all I've been doing. That's why I don't lift anymore.
Yeah. Holy crap. That's incredible.
So moving forward, you got meet this weekend. What's on the horizon beyond that for you?
So long term, I absolutely want to move up to 198 because, you know, metabolism or not, I want to eat a little bit more than I am now. And I think my leverages would be better in a little bit bigger weight class. The one meet that I've done, I guess I've done two meets at 198. But the first one I did where I actually, you know, filled out the weight class almost, was the best total I put up. And that was a year ago. So I feel like I'm much stronger now, but my leverages aren't quite as great as they were. And so long term, that's absolutely what I want to do. I still think, you know, records are kind of something that I'd like to do in terms of my career, at least have say that I, you know, I set an all-time world record once. And so right now I feel like maybe I have a better shot at that at 181. And so it's kind of up in the air about when I'm going to move up, but that's in the next year or so, definitely something that's on my horizon.
Is the total record at 181 is Malik?
Right Malik, now? Yeah. He has, I think, both the sleeve and the wraps. I'm not positive, I'm pretty sure. Okay. And then... both are Jesse Norris has both at the 198s right now. Even though he said it in sleeves, it's higher than the wraps.
That's like 2033.
Yeah,
yeah, we saw that.
Yeah.
Grind Sports Nutrition is the official supplement provider of Team Juggernaut, designed by Renaissance Periodization. These are no nonsense supplements to fuel your hardest training. Use JUG10 at grindsupplements.com. So moving forward, what do you think, what are the things that Ben Pollock has to do to improve as a lifter?
So by far my three priorities right now, and I've written a little bit about this, for my squat, I need to get more comfortable in the wraps, because if I nail my technique on the squat in wraps, I can put up a lot more than I actually have in a meet right now. So I have to be able to do that every time, right?
What kind of carryover do you think you're getting sleeves to reps?
I think I could easily get 100 pounds.
What are you currently getting, you think?
Currently, probably around half that.
Oh, well.
Maybe a little bit less. Because I've hit 700 in sleeves in a meet a couple times, and my best in wraps is 738.
Okay.
And I really think I can get a lot more out of those. For my deadlift, I got to bring up my grip strength, because I haven't pulled 815 once in a meet. I'm only going for 800 at this next one, and that's definitely a limiting factor for me. I think, you know, if my grip were, if I could pull in straps on a meet, pretty sure I could put up 850, but that's not an option. So those are by far my first two, my most two obvious priorities. I just got to get my bench up. My bench sucks, like, compared to anybody else, not even an elite level, but just for my weight, my bench is not very good. And so for me, that's always been one that's more slow to develop, and figuring out exactly what I need to bring up. Pretty sure it's, you know, shoulder, pec strength, but that's going to be a bit of a longer process, trying to be a bit more patient with that.
What is your best bench?
424 in a meet, and I 425 in the gym, so.
You beat Max.
Okay. what are like top 181s benching?
Malik is close to 550. I know he's done 198 now.
Malik's, yeah, I think he's
in a different world.
I think he did 523. I think it's his best meat bench.
And yeah. I think the record right now is 556, which was set back in the 1980s too. I think.
Who is that?
Rick Weil. I might be.
Rick Weil.
He's got a lot of bench records.
Yeah.
Kevin benched 440 at 181.
Yeah.
But like I said, it doesn't. The only lift that matters is the total.
Yes.
The total lift. So however you get there. In the transition from sumo to conventional, what are some adjustments that you've had to make? Because I mean, for anyone who follows you on Instagram, your deadlifting right now is just insane. It's like every other day you're putting up these videos of huge 5-rep and then a huger 5-rep and then a huge 3-rep and then a huger 3-rep.
So for me, sumo, I really like sumo because it's easier for me to recover from. It's not putting as much strain on my lower back, and so you know, I can do it more frequently, and that's a big deal, both in terms of, you know, training intensity and all that stuff, frequency. But when I first started out pulling sumo, I tried to just kind of jump into it and was basically doing a bastardized conventional deadlift with my feet wide apart, and actually tweaked my back a little bit, which I almost never do. I don't have back problem. My lower back is a strength. You know, just being an idiot, more or less, trying to jump into it too quickly. But it turned out to be a good thing because when I, you know, healed up in a couple of weeks and came back, I took it much more slowly and really learned to get my hips, my glutes, my hamstrings into the movement more. And so that's why I really prefer sumo to conventional, because with conventional, I struggle to get that same activation with the posterior chain. And I think I don't lose out on my lower back strength with sumo, so I can kind of get more muscle into it, essentially.
Would you suggest for other lifters out there to train their opposite stance very frequently?
Yeah, definitely. Even if, you know, one feels really awkward or uncomfortable, I think doing it light, just getting the volume in, I think that can really help strengthen those muscles, and there's going to be carryover for almost everyone. And so regardless of whether, you know, you lift sumo or conventional in a meet, bringing up your hips, your glutes, your lower back, they're both involved in both lifts, and so they're very complementary.
Now, beyond the main lifts, you said, you know, for squatting and deadlifting, pretty high specificity, just kind of changing wraps or sleeves. Deadlift, just changing the stance. From an accessory work standpoint, you know, very impressive physique. Seems like you have to have done quite a bit of hypertrophy work at some point in your life. What's your accessory training looking like?
So you're totally right. When I started out training, I was basically doing like power building type stuff, where it was, you know, had the squat, bench, and dead in there, but then there was a lot of bullshit, frankly, of pull downs or leg press or whatever, which probably did give me, you know, a good base of muscle that's been valuable. But nowadays, my accessory work is very, very minimal, and it's pretty half-assed too. But I'll do, you know, glute ham raises, reverse hyperextensions. I'll try and do some upper back work. A lot of times I forget it, but, you know, I'll do a few sets of pull downs or seated rows or something to try and get a little bit more lat work. But mostly when I am doing stuff, I'm trying to, you know, focus on those bench weaknesses, which is pecs and the shoulders. So lots of stuff, especially for the rear delts, which I feel like is a weakness for me. And then super light stuff for the pecs, which I feel helps me get them into the movement a little bit more on bench. So, you know, honestly, I think it was yesterday, actually, I was doing dumbbell flies on a Swiss ball with 20 pounds, just trying to get that pump. But for the most part, I don't really incorporate accessory work except as injury prevention. Unless
dumbbell fly is a highly undervalued exercise. I had like this little off-season training cycle that I did where I was benching four times a week and I started doing flies twice a week. But I didn't do anything over 80% until the last day of it, and I went and benched a five pound PR. And really the only significant change to the training was, yeah, benching one day a week more, but the dumbbell flies, and people, you know, kind of laugh them off as this, you know, bro exercise, like for mankini guys or whatever, and forget that that's a great chest developer and the bench is a chest exercise.
Absolutely.
And I think there's a lot of value in those kind of smaller movements, particularly for the bench press, which probably is influenced the greatest by like hypertrophy work and general work, which is probably why you see, you know, gym bros have big benches. Much more rare to see a gym bro with a huge squat or deadlift.
Yeah, totally agree. And so, you know, maybe I need to do more hypertrophy work, but I don't want to go mankini yet. So, you know, maybe down the road.
Being mankini is not a good place to be in your life.
Always a negative.
It's always a negative. It's always a regret. You're you're outside the norm. You're outside the little inner circle of people that are positive in your life. So what do you think, your training, you know what your training looked like early in the beginning. Now it's a little different as a 181. What is it going to look like for you going into 198s so if you do move up? And you cut some weight to make the 181s?
To make 181s, I cut a bit. I'm sitting around right just under 200 pounds. So, like, on a good day, I'll wake up 198, 199. On a bad day, it's like 201. So, yeah, that's – I mean, it's a sizable cut.
So what would you expect to walk around at as a 198?
Hopefully 220. Cut about a similar amount of weight, still a manageable amount, but, right, you know,
and then significant amount, well, of what would more. You think would change for you to keep yourself that heavy? Or do you think you would just be able to get up there?
It would – it's going to be hard to get up there. I've never been that heavy for more than, you know, a day or
week. You don't just get sloppy fat after you overeat?
No. Okay. I mean, I can't make myself eat that some areas, much. But I go through, you know, half the pizza, half a cycle in, and I'm just like, nah.
That's why it's cycling, carb cycling.
Yes. You got to be progressive about it.
Yeah. You start with cheese, pepperoni the next week for an overload, maybe sausage the week after that.
And then isn't there something?
Taper down to just garlic bread, deload, then you're back up and you PR with, like, you know, a stuffed crust or a deep dish.
There's some part where you just have to.
It's all right there, guys.
Get a bottle of olive oil, right, and just cover the
pizza. That was old Dave Tate thing.
I heard that one, yeah.
Yeah.
Stare at the pizza that's standing between you and the doors.
That just sounds like the ramblings of a very, very overweight man. Anyways, what do you think, like, your training would look like? I guess different than now. That's dramatically different. Obviously, you're going to do same stuff, but
I'd like to be able to increase my frequency. Right now, I have a very hard time recovering from training more than 4 days a week. But I really like to train, and I feel like looking at a lot of other lifters, they seem to train, you know, five or six. I don't think seven, but 5 or 6 days a week. That's something that I'd love to be able to do. And hopefully, you know, that increased calorie intake would give me the extra recovery to be able to handle it. But as it is, if I try and bump it up, it's just a nightmare. And honestly, a lot of times what I'll do is train 2 weeks. I'll train 4 days a week. And then that third week, I'll only train 3 days and just skip the last day and take that extra weekend to recover.
So are you doing that, the change in training frequency, in lieu of using, like, deloads ever?
Yeah, definitely. And usually what I'll do is, so if I feel like I need a deload, I call them half-ass deloads, where I'll do my light workouts as normal, which is still, you know, in the 70% range. And then for my heavy workouts, I'll just cut those back significantly. And honestly, sometimes I'll only do 50% on the competition lifts and then add in a little bit more bullshit. Maybe single leg press, some type of hypertrophy work that's going to get a little bit of blood flow and keep that recovery up without going crazy. And then, yeah, take an extra day or something. But usually I can get by, and then it's, you know, 4 or 5 days versus a full week. If I take a full week to deload, like in a conventional style, I come back that next week, I feel terrible. I just feel like out of the groove, rusty, everything hurts. And it takes me, you know, another week to get back into it. So then there's 2 weeks of training you kind of blew, and so I try and avoid that.
Trifecta provides pre-cooked organic food delivered right to your door weekly to help fit with your Renaissance diet, fuel your hard training, improve your recovery, and make your life easier. Visit trifectanutrition.com/juggernaut. Coming up for the rest of the competition year, Do you know what meets you're doing?
I don't. Right now, you know, best case scenario, I get the deadlift record next Saturday. I take off until maybe November, maybe even January, and try and get up to that 198, maybe come back for Reebok record breakers. There's a lot of super strong guys that are doing the strength showdown in Louisiana. That's around that same time in November. And then there's the LA Fit in January that Steve Dennison's put a lot of prize money together
for. Yeah, me. I heard that got bumped up from the past couple of years.
Yeah, and that's a meet that I've never done. It's a bigger one. You know, I like this area. I'd love to come back. And so those are all kind of on my radar. But in terms of committing, I wasn't planning on doing this one on Saturday, so I'm kind of flying by the seat of my pants right now.
So who knows? You might pick another random one coming up.
Yeah.
So, Ben, where can people learn more about you?
So I have a website, phdeadlift.com, which is my Instagram handle. It kind of links to all my different stuff. But I also have a blog at Elite FTS. That's where pretty much anything that I've written is going to show up there.
All right. Max, what do you got coming up, bud?
We got a seminar in North Carolina, July 8th. You guys can...
Do you have any spots for Texas next week?
The Texas one is... there's some spots for Texas. That's on the 3rd, Saturday. Just the weightlifting. We canceled the powerlifting one.
Mm-hmm. Is it because my powerlifting one was so much more popular?
Probably everybody went to yours instead. Yeah. But your weightlifting seminar was empty, so I capitalized there. And that's in Brazos Valley Barbell.
Brazos Barbell.
And then we're going to be in... Buffalo in August.
Yeah, that one's way off. They can't sign up for that one yet.
Yeah.
I will actually be in Austin with Ben, totally unplanned, but at the Naturally Fit Games. What's the name of your meet there?
I think it's the Naturally Fit USPA meet.
Okay.
I don't think they have a different name.
Oh, you know what? I might actually be able to go there. So I won't be anything on Sunday. Is that when it is, Sunday?
No, Saturday. It's Saturday.
The 3rd.
Yeah, my clinic's
on Sunday. If you do well, I'll stop by and say hi.
Thanks.
Marissa and I will be at the Naturally Fit Games. So if you're there on Saturday, we'll have a booth, which I think is right by the powerlifting. But if it's not, you'll find us. I'm the large gentleman, so I should stand out in the crowd. And Austin Seminar is sold out. Next stuff coming up beyond that is... I don't think I have any other seminars.
Yeah, I think it's kind of... Lots of competitions.
Yes.
Yeah, lots of competitions coming up. Our meet the 11th.
June 11th. Meet here at Juggernaut, August 20th. Weightlifting meet on June 11th. Powerlifting meet August 20th. So make sure you guys sign up for those. Check out juggernautcoaching.com or Juggernaut Online Coaching on Instagram. We have the new Super Total programming going on, as well as, of course, powerlifting and weightlifting training. A lot of different levels. Different coaches, different levels of involvement that you guys can get, but definitely something to fit any lifter's needs. And where can they find you?
You find me on Instagram, max_Ada, or email me, max@jtsstrength.com.
I'm Chad Wesley-Smith, at Chad Wesley-Smith and at Juggernaut Training on Facebook and Instagram, filling up your news feeds all day. He's Ben Pollock, at PH Deadlift. Thank you very much for joining us today,
Ben. Thanks for having me.
Good luck next weekend.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Hopefully we get to see the record happen. If you enjoyed the podcast, please stop by iTunes, give us a 5-star review. That really helps out on the charts and the rankings on there. And we'll see you next week.